And the scripture for today is from Matthew chapter 4, verses 23 through 25, if you'd like to follow along in your Bibles. Jesus went through Galilee, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the good news of the kingdom and curing every disease and every sickness among the people. So his fame spread throughout all Syria, and they brought him to all the sick, those who were afflicted with various diseases and pains, demons, epileptics, and paralytics, and he cured them. And great crowds followed him from Galilee, the Decapolis, Jerusalem, Judea, and from beyond the Jordan.
Well, I'm very excited about the series. This is the second Sunday of the Land of Milk and Honey, and you can see the picture of the book on the front of the handout that is stapled to your bulletin. So if you have that out and a pen and a pencil, and we'll be filling in the blanks as we go along, that will be a wonderful little take home for you as a reminder of what we learned today together. Now, the book is mainly, as I mentioned before, we have some new folks here with us today, so you may not be as familiar. That's the reason why I repeat the information on the handout at the top. But this book mainly talks about the geography of the country of Israel. But I find such inspiration from it. It brings the Bible alive to me. It answers a lot of the why questions. So I'm hoping you enjoyed last Sunday. I hope you can see how it applies to today and to know that it does make a difference, just having this knowledge of understanding the background. There is a saying that only God knows and only God sees the full potential in all of us. And that's reflected in one of our beloved hymns that we've been singing, "In Every Bulb There Is a Flower." You enjoy that song. I know that's more of a spring song, but we're going to get to witness this yet again this coming spring. But the basic truth of that is that there is growth and there is a future before us that only God can see. So we can walk in confidence regardless of any amount of evil, any amount of disease, any amount of persecution, or any general hatred that seems to affect us. We can stand firm on the promises of God. And that was the theme of last Sunday in the handout that we filled out, the promises of God. And we can know through this that God is still in control. So this morning, we're going to take a little closer look at the geography. We're going to learn a little bit more about what is it about the promised land that God gave Abraham that we can learn from. Now, if you're reading a novel and you're sitting in an English class, they will say what we're studying today is the setting. So that's what we're going to be doing. We are going to be studying the setting of where Jesus ministered. So with the first frame, we've got it there. That's good. You got your pens and pencils ready. One of the main aspects of the country that we have to look at, if you look at the map that's on the back, you can see that the western side of the country of Israel, called Canaan, is built upon and lies next to the Mediterranean Sea. It runs the entire length of the nation. So we'll look now at the next slide. This is one picture of the Mediterranean Sea. And we may say, well, if you look at mainly at the insert there, the fishermen, we know that the disciples were found fishing not in the Mediterranean Sea, but in the Sea of Galilee. So if you look at the little insert, you will find, I think I drew an arrow to it, the Sea of Galilee is at the very top. Do you see that right above Nazareth? Okay. So Jesus spent his time there, but he also baptized and was baptized in the Jordan River. If you look at the Jordan River, you will see that it runs from the Sea of Galilee down to the Dead Sea. That runs on the eastern side of the nation. So from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea, from the length of what you see in the insert, that is what is Israel today, called the Promised Land or the Canaan back in Jesus' time. I find it fascinating that we never really hear of Jesus out on the Mediterranean Sea. He walked on the water, but wasn't on the Mediterranean Sea. It was on the Sea of Galilee, right? But you understand it better once you see it, once you look at the pictures, once you've been there, you can understand why not much time was spent by Jesus or the disciples on the Mediterranean Sea. And there are several reasons. The first one is we may want to ask, well, why wasn't an active seaport? It simply was not in Jesus' day so much. And why wasn't, and especially before Jesus' day? Here's your first blank. It's because, according to this book, there are no deep water ports. There are no deep water ports the entire length of this nation. It is either too super rocky or it's so shallow that if they need to unload the goods, if they bring anything from the Mediterranean Sea on a ship to that area, they literally had to unload everything on smaller boats and then take the smaller boats to the land and just hope they didn't wreck in between, right? So that's one main reason why it was never a seaport. All the cargo had to be carried off. It was too much, too time-consuming, and too dangerous. You know that there are pirates all around. So when you have a large area and you're taking all the time to do this, it just made it very dangerous. So other cultures north and south of the Canaanites actually had stronger seaports, which is probably one reason why Egypt was so wealthy. It could trade by the sea, and Israel simply could not back in the early days. But here's an interesting point. By the time Jesus is alive and he's doing his ministry, we know that there is a civilization that's in control of this area, and that's the Romans, right? And you have Herod the Great. Who named him Herod the Great? Why, he did, of course. I am Herod the Great. He took 12 years to build a singular seaport. Why? Now, he would claim to others it was because so I can bring the wealth of other countries in. But according to this book, the reason why he did it is he was so insecure in his position there, surrounded in a country. He's in a foreign country. He doesn't come from there. And everything is so tenuous that he doesn't think he's going to last. So it is exactly, he creates it so he has an escape route should it all go down bad. Isn't that interesting? So the seaport took 12 years to build, and it was primarily so Herod the Great would have a quick exit route. So the coastline, now you can imagine it still has water, right? It still has food in it. So it is still greatly populated, and it does have the best living conditions. But it still has the least amount of biblical history. The coastline has the least amount of biblical history. As we look at the next slide, this area, this promised land, was overrun time and time again by other civilizations. They didn't come in through the Mediterranean Sea. They came from the north or they came from the south. And so I want us to look at this, and I want you to note where the blue arrows are. I'm trying to help you out a little bit, and you also have the blanks there to fill out. During the time of the patriarchs, that's Abraham, his son Isaac, Isaac's son Jacob. During the time of the patriarchs, it was controlled by the Canaanites. It was controlled by the Canaanites. How do you spell it? Put Canaan and then put the ites at the end. Canaanites. In the time of the judges, it was controlled by the Egyptians, which is found, obviously, in Africa. But what's funny is when you go to Egypt, they tried to exclude themselves, didn't they? We're not really Africans. We're Egyptians. They have their own civilization. Now, King David did defeat these cultures, those two cultures, and he did gain a lot of the use of the coastline, but it was only briefly, because as soon as his son Solomon took the throne, it reverted back to other civilizations as Assyrians, your first blank, as Babylonians, as the Persians, and as the Greeks. It's overrun by four civilizations: Assyrians, Babylonians, Persians, and Greeks. Now, where were they? If you look at your map again, you can see Assyria. You look at the second blue arrow there, and you can also circle it on your map. Go up where you see the triangular line on the map on the back side, and right where you see Nineveh, circle that. That's Assyria. Babylonia is just south of that. You can circle that. You would know, Abraham would know that culture well because he came from Ur. That's where he originated from. Now, what you don't see on this map are the Persians, and I put it up here, but it's not on this. Now, the best way to find how much did the Persian Empire hold, take your hand, spread your fingers, put it over Egypt, and then just swish it all the way to the right till you go off the map. That was the entire Persian Empire. They had everything from Egypt to India. They had a vast amount of land. Where were the Greeks? Well, go back up to the very top and where you see the Hittites. The Hittites, you can circle that, those were Turks. And the Turks, of course, came from Turkey. The Greeks and the Turks fought all the time. There was a constant war, it seems, between these two civilizations. So much so that even their languages became intermixed. And I found that interesting. So the Greeks would have been, and the Hittites more from the north side. Now that's the Old Testament. I just gave you 1,000+ years of history in about one sentence. And I hope that's okay. By the time we hit the New Testament, the influences of all of these cultures are still there. They're still there. They didn't always leave. Just because they were defeated, they are layered. These cultures are layered. The people are layered from all these different cultures. And layering on top of all these cultures are the Romans, which is why Herod the Great was probably a little insecure. The Romans stay in control of this area all the way through the New Testament, and that's important to note. The Romans are in charge the entire New Testament. Now, that's a little bit of geography, that's a little bit of history, but I think the fascinating point of all of this is to look at the truth that lies behind this. Land, if you look at the map, you'll see that the land does not change much. What God created remains there. The deserts are still deserts. The mountains are still mountains. Mediterranean Sea is still there. Okay. Jordan River is still there. The land doesn't change much. But as you look at this map and you look at what you filled in, the cultures change drastically and change with frequency. The cultures change. I think it's fascinating, as we learned last week, this area is the size of what state here in the U.S.? Maryland. Good. I'm checking your memory here. It's the size of Maryland. And we talked about, we thought for sure God would give them something the size of Texas or Colorado at least. But no, he gives them Maryland. That's only how large it is. So how many miles generally, this is the larger number, goes north and south? 200. And the width? 100. It's 200 by 100. But within this, you have two mountain ranges. You have the mountain range above the Sea of Galilee that's called the Mountains of Lebanon, which is what the disciples and what we saw as we were sitting in the boat in the middle of the Sea of Galilee, as you see the mountain range to the north. There's another mountain range that runs, again, east-west, that's south, and that's called the Wilderness of Zin, the Wilderness of Zin. And then you might as well throw in, again, all the little hills, and they're not little hills, they're big hills in between. Throw in a Dead Sea, and you have a lot of condensed area. And as we flew over it, as we took the bus from spot to spot, we wondered where do all these people live? Because there's not much there to be seen. You get out of the city and there's not much there to be seen. But it's amazing how God can work and how God can use this. So where did their wealth come from? We hear in the Old Testament, we hear of King Solomon, the great wealth he accrued. Remember that? Well, maybe partly it came from some of these civilizations that they conquered. But according to this author, he states that the greatest wealth never came from natural minerals, and it never came from silver or gold. This promised land didn't have any of that. Now, wouldn't you think God would have provided some of that? Solomon, in his day and time, and his father again was King David, Solomon controlled the international highway. Isn't that fascinating that there was an international highway that existed even back in the day of Jesus? And there are actually three main roads. Those are our study for next week, so I'm not going to touch upon that much. But I want you to recognize that these highways were so narrow, when they were controlled, you had no choice but to stop and pay your tax. It was heavily taxed. They were taxed for everything back then. That's how King Solomon grew great wealth. It was through taxation. Well, that sounds familiar, doesn't it? So their wealth was not accrued, again, by oil or by natural substances. It was mainly through taxation. And we discussed very briefly last week how this was easily done for them because they were a crossroads. Anyone from Egypt that wanted to go north had to go on that highway or one of the three. Anyone who was north and wanted to get to Egypt had to cross through the promised land. They had to. And so if you were on the international highway, you got tax going and you got tax coming and going. Isn't that fun? That's the bad news. That's the bad news, and it was back then. But here's the good news. Because it was a crossroads, Jesus could get the word out very rapidly to people coming and to people going and just passing through. So the word of God could get out very easily, and why God chose the promised land, because it was a crossroads of all of these cultures, of all of these cultures. In a similar way, you and I here at Lincolnshire have also great diversity around us. And I love that. For those of you who have been a part of the church for the past 20, 30, and I mean for some of you, 40, 50, 60 years, right? You can see what has changed and what has not changed. Now, I'm just going to make a little plug here. We got to talking about this the other night, and I know the Drudges aren't with us, but Casey wrote this book. How many of you recall seeing this book about the history? Okay, very good. It's the history of Lincolnshire written from about 1894 to 1994. And he says, there's books up in the attic somewhere, so we went up and got them. I brought down 8 of them. Please take one. And if you'd like to have more, there's a whole box of them upstairs. So we have a ton of these to give out. And I had a blast going through this, seeing how many of you I still recognized. And seeing what names I might recognize, because my father was in the ministry and would have known some of these men. And so I heard some of these names. Of course, a lot of them are legendary, right? But this is such a beautiful book. We have this history. And as I'm looking at those pictures of the dedication, when they put in the cornerstone, when I was 2 years old, the cornerstone of this church, the church looks exactly the same. It hasn't changed. It looks exactly the same. But if you look at the people in the church, if you look at the pictures then, 100 years ago to now, obviously, there's going to be change. Every single generation brings its change. It brings its change. So there is a diversity sometimes just that's brought in with a new generation. And we celebrate this diversity. We certainly celebrate it in nature. Aren't we blessed to be here at autumn time to describe the changing of the colors of the leaves as something a lot of states do not know? We embrace the colors of the rainbow. We embrace what God gives us in variety and diversity. So we embrace diversity. It becomes our challenge, the same way it became the challenge of the patriarchs, again, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, when they had to live through various phases. Keep in mind, that's 3 generations. There would have been a change with the country, with the area, in culture, with every single generation. To accept what they were given by the time of their day and what they were given by God. It stretches our resources. It stretches our attitudes. And it hones our skill to reach a more diversified culture, doesn't it? Now, you and I, we have the privilege of shopping anywhere we want in Fort Wayne. We can go anywhere we want. And what's so fascinating to me is how many of you drive such a distance just to attend this church. But regardless of where we live, regardless of where we shop, the church is on the south side of Fort Wayne. This is where it's at. This is where our ministry is, here on the south side of Fort Wayne. This is our platform. So let's go back to our maps. Let's go back to Jesus' time and look at the platform of where Jesus did his ministry, which is the topic and the theme for this week. Did he stay in just one location, or did he service and minister across the entire scope of the promised land? Well, let's look at the next slide. Excellent. Now, Peter and Paul, as you look in the New Testament, if you look at their letters, you know they went along the coastline because that's where a lot of the people were at, right? That's where a lot of diversity is at. That's where the international highway is at. That's where you're going to be crossing in between and finding people. But the coastline was not Jesus's area of ministry. Jesus stayed in what is called the central mountain zone of Israel, which I have typed and put on your handout. And it contains 2 regions. The first one is called the Upper Galilee. That's your first blank. And the other area is called the Lower Galilee, as you can see by the mountain. Now the mountains on the upper Galilee end are twice as tall as the mountains on the lower Galilee region. And it is in this lower Galilee region, here's your next blank, that houses the most dramatic stories and houses where Jesus did the majority of his ministry. It was in the lower Galilee region. If you look at this area, and I'd like you to take a little time to look at this map, especially the insert, you'll see that I added a few cities. I don't know why they were missing Nazareth, so I had to put that in up there by the Sea of Galilee. And for whatever reason, they were missing Jerusalem, which is the capital. So I had to put that in for you as well. Now we know that Jesus was born where? Where was he actually born? In Bethlehem. And you'll see that's near Jerusalem. But that isn't where he was raised. He was raised where? In Nazareth. So go ahead and take your finger and go shoot all the way up to Nazareth. And you will see that was the main area where Jesus did the majority of his ministry. Yes, we know he ends up in Jerusalem, but the majority of his ministry was there. It was up there with towns as we would recognize Cana, where he turned the wedding, where he turned the water into wine. And imagine Jesus's parents traveling from one location to the other. It's quite amazing. Now, halfway in between Nazareth and Jerusalem, halfway in between, you see those two locations that I gave you, I circled the name of the city. Now, this is not the modern day name. I want you to look at Shechem. Do you see where I have circled that? Halfway in between. Shechem is, the more modern name is Nablus or Nablus, N-A-B-L-U-S. Okay? And in the New Testament, it carries even a different name. It's called Sychar in the New Testament, which is S-Y-C-H-A-R. So this town carries three different names. It carries Nablus or Nablus, Shechem, and Sychar. All right. But in Jesus's day, it was called Shechem, mainly in the Old Testament. That's how you see the reference. And it is here where he meets the woman at the well. In Shechem, that is the heart of the central mountain zone. It's the heart of it. And it was considered a transportation hub. So a lot of people cross through here. Now, it's important for other reasons as well. Abraham, also called Abram, made his first city stop here in the Promised Land. God spoke to him here. God spoke to him here and told him what his promise was for him. It was here at Shechem. Other major events happened right here in the same city. When Joseph's bones were returned from Egypt, this is where his body was laid to rest. And we see this in Joshua chapter 14. Joshua, and I love this one, Joshua had a dedication service here prior to riding off to battle to conquer the land, issuing this call to arms. Now, to be honest, I never knew this was a call to arms. I don't know why I managed to forget this, because it stands in our home at the lake house. Joshua says, you're going to recognize it, choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve. But as for me and my household, we will serve the Lord. This is where Joshua stood and made this proclamation. The same spot where Abraham said and was told by God that he would lead a great nation, the same place where Joseph's bones were laid. This is where Joshua says, "For me and my household, we choose to serve the Lord." Let's look at the next clip. I wanted to, you can see the blue arrow here on the slide up above, and you can see where I have Shechem pointed out with a blue arrow. This is very important because two major stories come from this area, from the New Testament. This is the area, here's your next blank, called Samaria. This area is Samaria, the area we just described. Now, the Jewish line were very prejudiced, as we know, of the Samaritans, because the Jewish line believed that if there was any mixed race within their bloodline, they were not true Jews, and therefore they were to be despised. They felt it was a betrayal of their faith to intermarry. They literally believed that. And they believed it to such a degree, they so despised the Samaritans. How could they not be of mixed race? Look at everybody who conquered them throughout the thousands of years. How could the bloodline anyway stay pure? And I would love to see a DNA test on those Jews, but that's my side. The Jews so despised the Samaritans that they literally would walk around Samaria to go either north or to go south. Now look at that map. If they are choosing to go around it, they either have to be willing to be taxed on the international highway that runs along the seacoast, or they have to be willing to walk on the eastern side of the Jordan River, because Samaria stretched in between that entire area. That isn't just going a few feet out of your way. That's not even going a few miles out of your way. That's going days out of your way because of a prejudice. Two great stories come from this area. Which one is one, Marty? Your good Samaritan is exactly right. This was a parable told by Jesus in order to show the people what their prejudice is. The other was the encounter with the woman at the well. Such a highly treasured story. This area should have been sacred to the Jews. They should have built a shrine here. They should have been doing pilgrimages to this city. This is their spiritual inheritance. This is where it all began. This is where Abraham was given the promise by God, and yet they avoid it. They miss out on the blessing of God because they fixed their own little rules of who you could love and who you could not love. They missed out on God's blessing. This should have been their pilgrimage. The thing that amazes me, too, is in the story of the woman at the well, we don't have time to read it all. We don't even have time to read it. I need you to go home and read it. This is where Jesus proclaims his messiahship. This is where Jesus proclaims his messiahship. It is here in Samaria, in the marginalized community, with the marginalized people that the Jews avoided at all costs, where Jesus claims his messiahship. Now, what I love about this woman at the well is she must have been very intelligent. She must have known the law. She must have known the scriptures, because she wants to discuss theology with Jesus. That's what she wants to do. She's hungry for it. She's hungry for it. She's smart. She wants to engage. And she becomes a little bit confused as Jesus tries to describe things. And she, not knowing who he was, she says, comes from scripture, "I know that the Messiah called Christ is coming, and he'll explain it." She has full faith that Christ is coming, that the Messiah is coming. What an amazing woman. And what I love is Jesus responds immediately with, "I, who speaks to you, am he." He reveals himself to her individually. "I, who speaks to you, am he," found in John 4, verses 25 and 26. Why? Why does he pick this place to declare his messiahship? Because this is where Abram built his first altar. This is where Abraham built his first altar. This is where Joshua rededicated himself and the Israelites to God's plan for the nation. It is this place, this location that holds great hope and promise for the world. Don't you love that? In this marginalized area, this is where God chooses to reveal himself and to make a great hope and a great promise. It is never an error in God's judgment that he reaches down and he blesses the meek, he blesses the humble, and he blesses the poor in heart. It is by no error of God that he blesses the marginalized people of the world and cares for them. God came to earth to sit with the sinners. He came to sit and to honor the marginalized. Jesus gave living water to the woman at the well that day. And we talked about the living water last week. And he gave living water to anyone who would listen. So let us share as we share in God's goodness by recognizing who God is and what his purpose is for our lives, for our church, and especially here on the south side of Fort Wayne. May we give him honor. Let's fill in the last few blanks. Let us as individuals and as a church, let us accept the diversity around us. Let us celebrate it. And let us support it. Again, let us accept the diversity around us. Let us celebrate it. And let us support it. Amen.